Cross my heart and hope to die. If I ever, ever told a lie, feeling send you, teacher said, to the bad place when you're dead. Washington, he never lied.
Hello, and welcome back to our podcast. But a fanfic of a fanfic that itself is a synthesis of Fallout, the popular game out of a post-apocalyptic wasteland, and My Little Pony, a popular show about pastel horses. Hi, I'm Fi. I'm joined once again with my co-host, Weird. Say hello, Weird.
Hello, this is Weirdington Esquire. And I want a podcast. I have to remember again and recount the last time we did the podcast. Podcast about a bad thing. A bad thing someone did to literature. And then a lot of other people read it, and then kept talking about it, and then wrote more things in its vein. It is a kind of cancer.
Yes, it is a kind of cancer. It's an infectious mind worm.
So anyway, our hero Blackjack, who is both whore and Madonna, fought some robo boys, some pony boys in robot suits, and they were real hard to fight, in spite of being no different than the previous robo boys that they could just kick over like sad turtles.
Yes.
And like one robo boy, his robo suit was so good that he was as dangerous as our first big villain that very apparently Somber wishes he hadn't gotten rid of all that time ago.
Oops, I done identified the person that I shouldn't have done identified.
So now it's just a new game plus as far as Deus goes. Like, it's well, Deus, but more so.
I mean, Blackjack's kind of on a new game plus, isn't she?
Fuck. So anyways, this asshole who should have died in, like, a nuclear explosion that blew up a building is back again. And he will come back in spite of the fact that this big knockdown dragout ended with most of the main cast coming back to fight, and then an EM field knocked out all of these dudes' armor. And so it remains a complete mystery why none of our intrepid heroes, especially like somebody with Psycho in their name, and another person who's like known for about a decade as the Beast of Hoofington,
yes,
and another person who is the Devil, none of them walked over to this like biggester and baddester threat, popped their helmet like a Pez dispenser and shot them in the forehead. Like,
yeah, they just rolled away. I guess they just wooed their way out,
unimpeded, like unobstructed.
Yes.
Fuck. All right, and then they in the cooldown after the big fight, everyone takes turns passing around the idiot hat, so that they can slut shame Blackjack for her like implausible decision to fuck Pony a highly sexual Count Orloff as played by Fabio.
Mm-hmm.
And in consternation with their bullshit, she just got on the wire, this like broadcasting system with an unknown range, and just bragged about it to anybody who would listen, i.e. anybody who with a radio on.
Yeah, imagine how weird that would be, where it's like, okay, say for whatever reason you don't know who Blackjack is, and like the radio just comes on and you just hear like graphic depictions of how she fucked a dude. And that apparently her girlfriend didn't know about it.
Yeah, okay, that was a thing that happened to me. Like, if this,
I guess it beats this, listening to the same 8 songs every day.
Yeah, I mean, if this shit were, like, self-aware and also not limited by the first person, like a montage of different people, like, in different situations listening to this, would be like, various different people whose, like, afternoon broadcasts are interrupted, and then, like, somebody, like, conducting some sort of, like, operation, and their, like, radio is, like, drowned, like, their signals to each other on their comms is drowned out by blackjack.
Right? And it's just this idiot going, "Attention, everyone, I had sex. Aren't you all proud?" It's so dumb. But, like, at least this is, like, an inoffensive, stupid dumb as opposed to the actual thing that's happening, which is, like, BJ is being made to feel bad about her sexual, like, escapades and doesn't understand why for no reason.
It's a bad thing. It's a bad thing that we're...
This is just flank all over again.
I feel sick inside. And not entirely for reasons related to the...
Yeah, it's promiscuity is bad, which is a terrible way to look at this whole thing.
That's not the problem here. There are... The problems with this whole fucking thing are myriad. And... The infidelity is the least of... So anyway, I think that was basically all that happened.
Well, they also go to Meat Locker and they meet a bunch of cool ghouls.
Like, oh, yeah, man. They meet the ghost with the most, and the other ghost with the second most, and so on down the line.
Yeah, they meet a bunch of cool ghouls that just are, like, trying to live their best undead self.
Oh, fuck, and then, yeah, it ended with Blackjack in the most, like, fucking hokey daytime television, like, "We walked into the room and you were standing above the corpse with a knife."
Yes. And then it zooms in on their face really awkwardly, and, like, and since it's like a soap opera, it, like, holds on for, like, a few seconds too long, and the actor just kind of has to stand there and, like, keep sort of pantomiming the same pose, but can't really do that because it's really awkward to hold that facial position.
And then freeze frame to, like, hold like, as the credits.
Yeah. So are the days of our lives.
Which really does, like, bring it, like, I was too exhausted to, like, and too angry to go into, like, sort of once again, it really does highlight, what are you gonna do about it, assholes? like you let these, like, three, like, whirlwinds of death into your town in the first place. Like, do you think that you have this person surrounded? You're in fact presenting a target-rich environment.
Yeah, it's one of those, like, "Stop right there, criminal scum. I'm gonna take the option that just says I kill all the guards, alright? Because they can't stop me."
Okay, so... Yeah, I mean, like, Somber doesn't... Like, this is another example of, power is just sort of big numbers without, like, any reference to, like, how it shapes the world or, like, how people, like, respond to characters differently. Like...
Mm-hmm. Yeah, we were discussing about this in a previous episode about how,
This is a scenario that, like, could have been reasonable and, like... Book one or something.
Yeah, like, Blackjack is now a cyborg, like, war god. There's no way that, like, anyone can reasonably stop her anymore. So the other thing I will also say is that this kind of stuff is also, like, endemic of, like, serial fiction, where you just need to get a new chapter out every month, and so you need to have cliffhangers to have surprising things happen. So this is just to have, like, a short ratchet of tension while you wait the next couple of months before the next chapter comes out. So, like, I kind of understand why this sort of stuff happens all the time in this sort of fiction, like, and it's forgivable and permissible in some ways, but it's still a really boring cliche for a protagonist to just walk in at a crime scene, everyone fingers her, or I guess they don't fingers in the story, they hoof at her, and be like, she's the one that did it, officer, and like, and then just leave us on that, and because like, there's only really two ways that can go, is either you make a chapter that's entirely about handling an incredibly boring, like, police procedural storyline, or they go completely scot-free. Like, there's really no other options you can really do in a serial fiction, because there's, the story isn't about crime drama, it's about big, giant, fantastical Fallout apocalypse adventure storytelling, so this can only ever be a roadblock that's annoying, or nothing, so it kind of falls away. Kind of flat to have these kind of reveals. This is less somber as a bad writer and more just helpful writing advice for the future of anyone that's listening to this, that like, this kind of stuff is fine in moderation, but doing it too often can lead to readers getting fed up with the way that all your stories, all, like every chapter seems to end with a cliffhanger that doesn't actually mean anything. You know?
I'm always faintly amused when we come in from a cliffhanger, and the first thing that happens is, oh no, it's not even like a question, like it just like a pretty common like, the writers are getting tired and trolling, is like a situation like this: a hero walks in, dead body, people walk in the door, the hero is holding a knife over a dead body. Cut to opening of next episode. The dead body gets up. Oh, I spilled jam all over my shirt.
Oh, thanks for holding my knife for me while you were doing that. Yeah, it's entirely copped out in like the next 4 seconds into the next episode.
Yeah,
yeah, it's very epidemic it's very much an epidemic of like television story writing, with the rise and advent of drama television series. This is when this really started to happen as a concept, because it was a great way of hooking people every season. But, you know, it gets really old very fast. But, yeah, anyways, that gives us a great opportunity to jump into our hook of Chapter 46. Chapter 46, Caper.
I thought I could stall you forever. I thought I could, like, get past the,
nope,
the 30-minute mark.
We have to actually talk about the chapter for once.
Fuck.
Yeah, I'm gonna call this When Are We Getting to the Fireworks Factory chapter.
Oh no! Go away, Poochie.
Because a lot of this chapter is them getting up to getting into Hightower. Because that's the thing that we're doing right now. That's what's the overarching story right now is happening. Is we need to get into Hightower Prison, because the next part of the egg hunt, fetch quest, collectathon. Breadcrumb they need to get is inside Hightower, and it's an impenetrable fortress, so they need to assemble a crack team of people to get in there.
Okay.
So yeah, we're introduced in this chapter from the cliffhanger for getting fingered by a cop, and then like within 4 seconds that cop is like, no, you couldn't have done this. There's no way you could have killed her.
Getting fingered by a cop sounds like a potential, an alternate title for every chapter that it heavily rests on BJ fucking.
Oh, I hate that. It's
sorry.
The...
It did have to be like, I am helpless but to.
It's Project Horizon's XXX, a porn parody.
So anyway,
try not to think about that too hard. But yeah, anyways, this is really just a scene to introduce another new character named Officer Graves. Well, she might have been the character that earlier that was menacing them at the door when they were first getting into this place, but I can't remember and don't care to. There are so many like ancillary like fluff characters; it's impossible to remember them all at this point. But she's some kind of hard-boiled detective that in her past life was a hard-boiled detective. And she like,
now that her skin's boiled off, she's harder than ever.
She's even more boiled. She's now a jerky boiled cop. But yeah, she gives a really forced backstory thing about her being a cop and how like being a cop sucked back then, because you couldn't arrest like ministry officials because they were untouchable, which I mean is like salient, but like also like a pretty like pretty low energy hot take.
I'm just imagining being like, yeah, okay, what does this have to do with anything? Like, I've got errands to run.
I've got errands to run and a dead ghoul on my shoe. But, her backstory is just vaguely tangentially related to one of Rampage's hitmates. Because the baby killer, who's known as the Angel of Death, was a nurse named Nurse Candy. And her whole thing was she was, like, euthanizing children in hospitals because she was, like... She basically became, like, an ultra-nihilist that believed that, like, it was more care to kill children than to let them live in this apocalyptic world. But, yeah, and she was, like, untouchable because she was, like, a ministry member and, like... Which could almost, like, be a thing, but, like, I just don't give a shit at this point. Like, I don't care. Like it's such a soft, cool take to be like, oh, yeah, justice is obstructed by, like, government officials. Go figure. Real hot take there, buddy. But she even complains to Lampshade about the fact that she gave her dumb backstory, like, freely to a random character, which definitely makes it okay when you put a Lampshade on it. Blackjack checks out the armor that she got from the dead ghoul that was giving her the new armor, so she now has cool SWAT gear to further cement her as the cool cop pwn.
So our protagonist looks guilty as fuck, but then a cop comes in and says, I'm a cop. And incidentally, my backstory involves being stymied by the government, getting in the way of my coppin'. Incidentally, I can tell this is a fellow cop, and so they couldn't have done it. Yes. Here, let me gear up this extremely guilty-looking cop. So,
yeah. And for those playing at home, the SWAT armor is very likely the armor that's on the cover of New Vegas. So that shows to further cement that this is meant to be the New Vegas of Fallout, which is, again, how dare you try to compare your fucking rank awful story to a far better piece of work, you absolute little shit. You fucking nothing. But yeah, anyways, ranting aside... Xanthe shows up, who is the zebra that thinks she's cursed, that was part of the zebra remnant. She just shows up here, I guess, even though apparently, like, the ghouls don't want the zebras in the town. She's here for bunch of dumb reasons. Part of it is she has nowhere else to go, because of being cursed and all. But also to, like, let us know that child that Blackjack thinks she killed definitely didn't die, and is somewhere in the hospital, just, like, being treated as a hospital. So, you know, even when she is guilty of things, she's not really guilty of them. Cool, thanks. That's what I wanted to hear.
Turns out you just ripped out her appendix with your teeth.
Yes, basically.
This was bound to have to come out anyway.
Like, I think the fic is becoming self-aware because she's like, I'm not a baby killer, I'm a baby mauler. It's looking at us, it can see us. The fic is becoming self-aware. Oh man. So, hey, does anyone want to learn about a bunch of fucking pointless zebra lore?
I don't. I can do without.
So, there's a...
How about we not?
So
do we have to?
I'm going to ignore basically all the lore of what's happening in the scene and more point out how this makes no fucking sense between these characters conversing. So Xanthe shows up and she's at the bar, and Rampage shows up on her soap booze bender. I don't know, she was really, really high on drugs. And there's a running gank about her drinking soap. But because another fellow zebra is around, Rampage slips into her zebra, like, immortal zebra warrior headmate.
No. Ooh, I didn't know we were doing stripe face today.
I was gonna say blackface on.
Ooh, Lord have mercy.
Rampage mocks Xanthe for her accent being bad because she like refers to her as a predator, which she only really didn't know that that's a traitor in Zebrin. Well, because she has red stripes.
The white lady Undertaker goes into her completely legitimate alternate personality of a black lady,
and then makes fun of the zebra for not speaking good enough zebra. It just gets worse as we go along. But she basically she tries to identify what tribe she is. None of the tribes matter. So something I'm gonna get it out of the way. I brought this up in a way earlier chapter. The story keeps trying to peddle this like complex zebra tribe lore where there's these 13 tribes and all the tribes have like unique, distinct hats to what the way that they function. None of them matter. It's all Somber just made up a bunch of dumb fantasy story bullshit. The only ones that matter for this story are Star Katari, because they worship the stars as gods instead of fearing them. And the only other one that we learned about in this thing is the Propoli, which just were the most populous, which is fucking on the nose as fuck. But they were the ones that kind of caused everything bad to happen. For some reason, so Shuja, which is the like, which is Rampage's like zebra soul, is like a weird nativist, which is confusing because she basically is like, oh yeah, you invented all this like. You invented the technology that burnt the world, like your tribe did, and also your tribe is the tribe that like decided to have trade agreements with Equestria and ruined everything. Which, okay, so whatever. A zebra that's a nativist, I guess, could make sense if they're really, really old and kind of racist. Shuja's backstory is that she fucked Twist and they raised a kid together. like what the fuck? Like, this doesn't make any sense that this character believes this. Like, this is pure utilitarianism. This is author writing a character that's babbling exposition in a way that needs to be said because we need to know it, but it doesn't make sense for the character to believe these things. You get what I'm saying? Like,
yeah, no, I'm currently lost in
Yes, Will, you see, of course, we are not objecting to individual zebra. We are fighting the international zebrary.
Is this your Zizek voice?
No, it's my... No. No, that's... You know, he would be... In the same... No! You are mixing up the ideology.
It just sounds like everything. It sounds like the Trapo Boys Zizek voice, so I got really confused for a second.
No, I was doing a variant quote from the Golden One.
Yes,
this is very like
how about just posh Tory voice? You see, no, there's no anti-Semitism here. I don't object to any individual Jews. There are many virtuous and valorous Jews. It is merely the international Jewry that is of concern. And this fucking, like, what you've told me about zebra lore so far is a little close to that.
Yeah, it's a zebra. It's a zebra who was in mad gay for an equestrian, apparently holds the belief that zebrans shouldn't have technologically advanced, so she's like a weird eco-fash, I guess, and on top of that, doesn't think that they should have converted with equestrian, like, believes that the equestrian trade deals are what caused the apocalypse, not, like, all sorts of other things that accelerated the war to happening, mostly resources. So, you know, that's wrong and bad. And also, why does this character think like this? Like, I don't get, like, this is out of character for a character that has had none up to this point. All we know about this character up to this point is that her soul-defining features is that she was an immortal badass, and also she had an illicit relationship with an equestrian, and that fucked up her career because of, like, xenophobia. And, like, that's all we have ever known about this person. And to find out that they're, like, a weird datavist is just a weird way to handle a character? And that's why I'm spending so much time talking about this instead of talking about the, like, deep zebra lore.
Well, I mean, like yeah, no, besides, outside of this character specifically, the zebra lore, that, as you've tried to articulate it, seems to be that there are good zebras. It just so happens that the majority population of zebras were Ashkenazi zebras who couldn't be trusted.
Yeah. Yeah, those zebras couldn't be trusted. Predators, the ones that, like, marked their skin permanently, those ones can be trusted. Yippee.
So we've, like, some more... some more race essentialism.
Yes.
Racial determinism. Sub-specific among...
The thing I will say about this is that the original FOE is not great about its race politics in general either. It does a lot of bad it has a lot of bad problems the way that it portrays zebras as well. But, like, this just, like, does its homework on how to be, like, the most chuddy about it. Like, it hits all the stereotypes and all the cliches as it hit before it hits the ground. Like, it's kind of impressive how much this is. Yeah, it's somewhere between, like Untermensch, like, hysteria combined with, like, yeah, like, weird Zionist conspiracy shit, almost. But, yeah, the only real important about this thing to find out is that Xanthe's, like, particular tribe is the tribe of, like, technicians, essentially, the technicians and makers. While on the other hand, like, Rampage... And, like, Rampage's headmate and also, and that, like, alluding to a zebra in the original story are part of the Echu, which are just, like, warrior types. There are Klingon zebras and there are technician zebras, whatever. But there is they need her help because she can help deactivate the Balefire bomb that's lodged in the Hightower, because it's the whole reason why the prison is a death trap, is it has a decaying, unfired nuclear warhead that's, like, stuck inside the building. But yeah, part of this I'm just going to skip by really fast. There's a bunch of them just assembling the rest of their dumb team of loonies that are going to help them, which wildly bloats this crew. Because keep in mind, like, this is... keep in mind, the crew of just regulars is Blackjack, Rampage, Lacuna, and Psycho Shy. But we also have Stygius, this new officer character. Officer Graves joins the crew. Xanthe joins the crew. The mayor of the town is gracious enough to give them the weird robot that guards the town. And then a local crime boss shows up and offers his bodyguard to the effort because he needs something in there as well. And there's the guy that they need to get in the building in the first place, a guy named Mr. Shears. So it's like 10 people.
And Fozzie Bear, and the little man who lives in Fozzie Bear's thumb.
This is a massive problem with late Project Horizons, is there's so much bloat to the cast that is really unnecessary. Like, we have basically completely exchanged 21 Scotch and Rainbow Glory are just exempt from the story for the next little while because they have nothing new to offer because they don't have the fighting capacity to keep up with the story anymore, and they lack the technical skills required for them to get into, like, to do anything anymore, so they've just been, like, temporarily fridged, essentially, which just feels like really, like, weak storytelling. Like, it feels like you're just, like, really, like if you can't include, like, if you're gonna make this big bloated principal cast, like, at least use them. Like, don't just fridge them at the nearest convenience. There's also, like, some dumb tomfoolery about Luna, or not, sorry, Lacuna being dressed up in a pretty, pretty princess dress, which I only really want to talk about because of a stupid, because of a weird line that doesn't make a lot of sense. So, they're basically talking about the idea that, like, it's like, oh, well, she's mentioning about how, like, it made her happy and how that's bad, and BJ questions that. It's like, well, because, like, happy feelings need to be excised from the goddess because... reasons, and the reasons are really, really poor. I've kind of tiptoed around a lot about the goddess's true origins, because whatever, just read the original story. But the goddess is actually like a its main body core consciousness that were the first people that were introduced into the goo, which is a combination of gestalt entity of like Twilight Sparkle, Trixie, which is a character that is a villain that shows up in a couple of episodes and are later redeemed in later seasons, and a pair of other like made up characters for the original story. And in the original story, it's implied that they're kind of just all like a mush of consciousness, where like where Trixie ends and Twilight Sparkle begins is not really clear, because like it they exhibit personality traits from all of them put together, and then like that like egotistical maniacal like personality floods into the rest of the consciousness, which is the thing I've talked about, like why I find the goddess so personally horrifying, is that like she is exuding a will on other people. She's not really a collective, but this interprets this as if they're separate entities that are constantly in a mind battle. And Trixie is keeping Twilight Sparkle's consciousness in a like locked state where she's siphoning her intellect, but if she ever regains consciousness, she'll be able to beat out the collective. She'll be able to control the collective away from her. And the way that she's doing, stopping that from happening, is taking happy emotions and putting them in the Lacuna as the dumpster file, because otherwise Twilight Sparkle will gain consciousness, which just like isn't, I don't think, the way that that works at all.
All we need to do is restore the true king.
Yeah. I think it's because there's a misinterpretation of something that happens in the original story, where like effectively in a metaphorical symbolic way, Little Pip defeats the goddess by giving her heart back, more or less, like essentially reminding her of her like humanity, and it destroys her, because it like makes her realize the things that she's done like are in, like atrocities, and it destroys her from the inside out. And I guess that like Somber took that way too literally and interpreted it as no, there's literally a key that if we slot it into a slot, it destroys the Death Star. Like,
right? Yeah.
Yeah. It's like it's
meanwhile
a,
like it doesn't make any sense that okay, yeah, no, she's the recycling bin folder. So what? like she, her existence exists as purging of these things, so like why can't she have like the things that the rest of the swarm is denied? Like, that's her job.
Yeah, like it's actually like contra wise to the rest of her things. Like, yeah, if she's supposed to be all like the sadness and maudlin and doubt and all that stuff rolled into a big ball, but if she's also the happiness, then like how is she not a more stable character? Like she's sort of presented as sort of something of an emotional wreck, but like she has happy feelings in her. Like, she has the power of friendship within her. If it's being excised deliberately from the goddess, then like why does she suck and is so dumpy? Is very confusing.
I think it's just something that like occurred to Somber this chapter.
Yeah,
I guess.
Yeah, I think mainly just because the FOE is wrapping up really soon, so we need to have callbacks to that since Lacuna is directly tied to the goddess.
Whatever.
Yeah.
If we talk about this, we can't talk about this. I would instead talk about Rasputin and how, while listening to a podcast about like sort of the history of Rasputin and like all the weird shit involved in that. One of the more interesting things that stuck out to me is that Rasputin, part of his deal is that he came from a like rural Russian background, and at that time in parts of rural Russia there were these like kind of bizarre like pagan holdover religious concepts, and priests like Rasputin were how Lacuna is described, basically. Like, they had license, and they were required to hyper-sin. to drink and pinch asses and, like, sleep around and say awful things that, like, was... Say all the stuff that's on everybody's mind, but Everybody should be too polite to ever consider like voicing. And so as a Christian priest, it is his job within that rural culture to take everybody's sins onto himself.
Reminiscent of the cultural role of the jester in a court, or at least the mytho-historical.
Sort of a sin eater.
Yeah.
And you know what? Any story about Rasputin doing anything is pretty hilarious. It's pretty fun. He was a wild and crazy guy. Like he wandered around a court, basically like he interacted with the Russian like nobility, almost literally like a live action real time Groucho Marx.
Yes.
And that's kind of why they had to kill him 5 consecutive times.
He had banked so much respawn.
I think the joke, the simple joke you can make is he's a Russian peasant. What do you want? Like this? Yeah. They're all like that.
They're all like that.
They just don't know how to die. Of course people like chalk it up to like, what if he did have weird mystic powers?
Yes.
Anyway, back to the fucking garbage fire the story is. I bring that up just to indicate once again
missed opportunities.
Lacuna for Horse Satan 2020.
Yes. Some sort of sin eater. But they assemble the crew. I just kind of wanted to bring up that Lacuna thing because it was just something that stuck in my mind that's kind of weird.
Yeah. No, I mean it's fair. Like it's technically noteworthy, I think.
Yeah, I don't know. I don't always want this story to just be like a dry recitation of things that have happened in the story, and sometimes meditate on like why some of these things are bad or missed opportunities. But anyways, they have to get one more member for their DK crew because they're like their plan is like, you know, they work out the entire plan of what they're going to do, where they're like, okay, we're going to go through the subway system into the sewers into a basement level of the tower. Unlock a special door using the EC-1101, and then get into the building proper from there through the library. And they're like, okay, that's suicide in step one, because the subway is massively full of ghouls, and they'll tear us to shreds. And I do kind of like the joke that the two ghoul members of the crew have a moment of confusion, where they're just like, well, no, the ghouls aren't going to bother us. And they look at all the living people around them, and they're like, oh, right. And I thought that was kind of cute.
that approach is clever.
But yeah, so the plan is they're like, okay, BJ has a brain blast and remembers, like, dozens of chapters ago at this point, in chapter 2, when that baby got eviscerated, the first of the babies to be eviscerated in this story. They became friends briefly with a ghoul who's kind of delusional and doesn't know where she is, but she has the ability to control other ghouls somehow. So she's being reintroduced into the story. Hell of a Chekhov's gun, but not really. So she's even
also you have
sorry
a also you have access in your crew a vanguard of 2 ghouls, a cyborg, an immortal killing machine, and Satan.
Yes.
What about these ghouls? poses anything like a threat?
So I think that it's just the sheer number. Like it's a staggering number of ghouls. It's too much for any one of like any of them to handle. Just the sheer numbers, which I can kind of like. I don't know. I buy it. Like I buy it as a concept. That, like it's like yeah, sure, whatever. A ghoul is not much. 10 ghouls isn't even that much. In our case, a few dozen ghouls isn't it, but it's literally hundreds and hundreds. It's a flesh sea of pastel colored rotting corpses. I don't know.
Shrug and next event. We have a ghoul wrangler.
We have a zombie wrangler. That can wrangle the zombies. They get weird innovation talismans that can help with the innovation in the building, since it's got a really high density of it, which are given out to them by Mr. Shears, which gets BJ questioning how he even knows how to make those. And he mentions, you know, kind of makes like a knowing wink about being from a different life kind of thing.
Ancient sea breeze secret. Wink, Dad. It's just tide.
A lot of this is also filled with a running discussion about soul magic. Yay, we get to learn about necromancy. So they get through the sewers. They fight a bunch of like acid slime monsters for a while. It's very D&D gelatinous cube stuff. It's not terribly exciting, but they do fight them, so it's something that happens. But yeah, they get into the basement of the building, and BJ like uses the EC-1101 to unlock something called Project Eternity. BJ questions Mr. Shears on this, and he kind of like shrugs, and it's like, it's not really relevant anymore, but it used to be like we were searching for an immortality serum of some kind. Hold on, my cat keeps wanting in and out. But and he kind of just explains like soul magic a little bit and how it works. Because Mr. Shear reveals himself to be something of a necromancer, like specifically like one of the last necromancers in Equestria. I won't try to get too hard into this because this is something from FOE, but in Fallout Equestria, at some point, Rarity, which is one of the Ministry of Mirrors, which is one of the main six from the original series, gets across a book on necromancy that came from the Zebralands. It's literally the Necronomicon from Lovecraftian mythos and the way it's described. But she unlocks a bunch of necromantic spells from it and did a bunch of shit with it. The goofiest of all of them is that she separated her, she carved off parts of her soul and put them into metal figurines of all of her friends in a weird, desperate attempt to try and repair her friendship with her other five other friends. So like those are artifacts in the stories that give you small stat buffs because they're a reference to bobbleheads from Fallout 3. I just talk about how dumb they are, but like whatever.
I mean, I don't know. I got nothing to say, and I've been quiet for a while, so I'll just say the only commentary that's come to mind, which is, yes, the Pony Namicon. Let's see here, reviving the dead as mindless servants. No. To rot a living body from the inside. No. Here's the spell I seek, the one of ultimate power. 1 minute baked potatoes.
truly, truly dark and nefarious magic. But yeah, it's a lot of background story stuff that will be set up for the next chapter, in the chapter going forwards, because we're almost at the end of this book, by the way. We've only got like two more after this one. Then we'll be doing another book recap, and then I don't even know what we're gonna talk about. But we're almost there. We just got a couple more things to describe. But yeah, Mr. Shears is some kind of necromancer. He works directly with Rarity because he had some sort of knack for being able to do soul magic. The way soul magic works is you can carve off parts of people's souls, which contains part of their identity and personality, and you can put it into things. And the soul, anything that's become a soul jar becomes indestructible by its inclusion within it. The problem with soul jars is they carry on a lot of the personality of the person in them. You kind of create these horrible, atrocitous nightmares that are like sentient objects. And just as they're like talking about this, they're besieged because they're like in a supply closet, and they're besieged by a bunch of sentient objects that fight them for a while. Which I'm super on the fence if this is really stupid or not, because on the one hand, it's really like, it's really funny and stupid to imagine a bunch of horses fighting a bunch of sentient objects that are just like beating them up and like comically like murdering them. But on the other hand, it's also just like really, really dumb and doesn't really amount to much. We just learned that like the Star Metal Sword can hurt them. They're not entirely indestructible. The Star Metal Sword can like injure soul jars somehow. That's the only real important part about it.
Did you get the broom closet ending? The broom closet ending was my favorite. Sorry.
It's fine. I just don't know what you're talking about.
Oh. Great game. Stanley Parable.
Oh, yeah. That is the Stanley Parable, isn't it?
Broom Closet ending is my favorite, though.
But yeah, when they get into the basement proper and into the library proper, they learn that, like, because of the weird hinky way that the building is designed, they can't. It's got like an anti-magic field on it, but since it's decaying, it conveniently allows them to still do normal telekinesis magic, but they can't do stuff like teleport out of the building. So there's no, like, they can't rope trick their way out of this one. Escape rope. I guess I'm conflating it with a different thing. They can't fast travel their way out of this building. I don't think, you know. But yeah, fuck. The pacing of this building is really confusing, so I'm just gonna take a second. Also, they get a robotic talking suit that isn't evil for some reason. And Xanthe puts it on. It's a reference. It's another really forced reference to New Vegas. It's a stealth suit that can talk to you. But in this, it's a soul-trapped suit that can only talk and regurgitate lines, and it, like, kind of mix-matches them to, like, make sentences out of, like, stock phrases. And Xanthe gets it because we're not, and I don't know. Xanthe has a stealth suit. This doesn't matter because we almost never see this character again. She's not part of the main crew.
Oh, that's a plus.
She's not a permanent addition. Yeah,
I'll take her over Psycho Shy.
Yeah. Nah, Psycho Shy's about to depart soon, too.
Good.
Yeah. I knew you'd be looking forward to that. But yeah, the actual description... Oh, so my one thing I liked about this chapter that I will give them is I like the description of this building a lot, because when they actually get into the prison proper, because it actually feels like the kind of thing that would definitely be a end of book, late story kind of location. It's an entirely full prison that's like the center of the thing has a warhead that's halfway through the middle of the building that is constantly raining balefire out of it. So there's just like this ultra hot blue fire that's spurting off of this thing constantly, that is so hot that anything it touches it'll melt through. The entirety of the, like, outside ring of prison cells is filled with prisoners that are ghouls that have been so irradiated they're now permanently on fire, and the whole building is being patrolled by sentry bots, which are giant robots that are still tirelessly patrolling their lanes. But the intense heat of the building has caused, like, the metal of the outside casings to be warped and distorted, so they look even more ghoulish than they typically do. And the entire time, there is, like, a mad ghoul who is the warden of the building, who's rambling almost incoherently through the PA system while this is all happening. I talked about this before, where, like, Somber has this amazing gift of making things that seem like they'd be really cool seem incredibly boring. Like, I once described how, like, they go to a mine that, like, an irradiated dragon died on top of. And, like, that should be the coolest thing in the world, but is, like, just a hole in the ground. This is like the opposite of that by like actually taking a cool concept and running it very well, and the prose like actually works for me. So this is one case of like descriptive prose of an environment that I think is actually super cool and sets the scene for the next couple of chapters of being this like fucking hell zone, this actual final location of an arc of the story. And I think that's really cool. But otherwise, that's the end of the chapter. Sorry.
So good on him for flexing that hard because he has to. Because I'm just thinking about the final end book points of the last two books. The first one was like sort of the kind of a natural culmination of the chase story we'd been on. Like we've just increased steadily escalating stakes of all these, like, disparate things trying to kill Blackjack and take her MacGuffin. And it all collides together and culminates in a big, crazy shoot-em-up, Vash the Stampede style, in a big Old West town.
Mm-hmm.
And then the second book, we spend the whole damn story on this fucking war arc. And the war arc makes no sense. Our character's investment in it makes no fucking sense. But you can at least give them that, like, that's been the focus of this whole fucking thing. Like, that's been the through line of the whole book. And we finally get to the big set piece battle. And the last minute reveal of, like, one side's apocalyptic super weapon. And we end the chapter with the destruction of Sed and the end of the war. So that's fairly coherent. And then this time, like, we spend a lot of time, like, it's very broken up. We spend a lot of time Million Dollar Manning our protagonist back together. The million bottle cap mare. And then we take a detour to, like, pop the balloon, we try and resolve, like, the villain of the entire story, but instead of, like, a big pop, Somber just, like, put the needle at the bottom of the balloon where the tension of the rubber is at its greatest, and it just farts until it deflates. But the book doesn't end, and we fuck around and eventually decide, let's get started on that, like, quest that we had, like, toward the beginning of the book that really made no sense and couldn't possibly, like, resolve into anything, and that everyone is just doing because our admitted moron protagonist wants to. And that leads us here eventually to what turns out to be a hell building.
Yes.
Okay. Like, so no one knows why we're going in there.
So I'm gonna talk about this more when we do the wrap up for this book. But I am of the strong opinion that if this story could have gotten any editing, like if I could make any significant editing passes to this as a formal book, I would say putting the final location, like putting Sanguine's entire business inside Hightower would have made way more sense in a lot of ways, and it would have made for a far more climactic finale, in my opinion.
Almost certainly.
I'll get more into that when we talk. Sorry.
We'd also have a reason to be, like, for our protagonists to be putting their lives and the lives of, like, a half a dozen other new people on the line for this. Like, I don't understand what the stakes are. I don't understand what the, like, expected payout is.
Yeah, they all want to go there for various reasons, but they basically all chalk up to, like, there's something in the building that me in a past life needs, or somebody in a past life needs, that I want.
Well, it says it right here in the script that we go
exactly
into the big hell building. So I guess
yeah,
that's
basically
what we're doing.
I don't know. Is there anything better we could be reading though?
Doing? There's a how about this? There's a weird obscure podcast that didn't get as popular as it should have, I think. It ended 2, almost 3 years ago now. In 2007, Creature Culture. It's still available on iTunes. You might be able to find it elsewhere. Creature Culture. It's two dudes just sort of talking about classic sort of D&D monster races and how they're underserved by D&D. And they basically just sort of world build about a setting without the, like, generic human and demi-human races, and, like, what if we told a story of a more interesting world with these weird ecologies and these weird peoples, and, like, how would they navigate the world, how would their societies likely look like based on the things that make them so different from human beings. I think that I have a vague memory that I was trying to build something out, like I was trying to, like, kind of think of a list of things to actually point to, that, like, not just stuff that I realized that I was pigeonholing myself by just trying to think of stuff that I'd done or experienced recently.
Yeah, and not just stuff you want to, like, microphone or megaphone, rather.
Yeah. So let's let that be it for this week. Creature culture. And you know what? The Stanley Parable.
I'm going to make a recommendation as well. So I'm going to make a recommendation for a series of cool puzzle games that I played over the last couple of days that are about $5 a piece. And I definitely think the altogether price of about $15 is definitely worth the price of all of them. It's a game series called The Room, which I don't know. I hadn't really heard much about it until very recently, but I like it a lot. It's kind of old, but it's a series of fun atmospheric environmental storytelling style puzzle games with a lot of like interacting with really weird cool machinery and figuring out how to unlock pieces to get to the next part in it. But the thing I enjoy a lot about it personally is it has a hint system which doesn't like mock you for using it, which I think is always a huge plus in a puzzle game. And it also, I find the puzzles to be personally just very intuitive. Like, I think that's a huge hurdle and a gap to get over in puzzle games, is to like make puzzles make sense once you get the rhythm of how they work and how they interact.
It's kind of like one of those old escape room games on Newgrounds.
Yeah, it's very much like that, but like far more complicated and very like a lot of the reward for solving puzzles is the spectacle of watching like the puzzle box like open up and twist and contort and all these like new, like it just, you know, just showers you with a bunch of new puzzle pieces and you're like, okay, cool, now this is the next thing I'm doing. And it's very, very interesting. And I think it's got a cool rhythm to it. So yeah, I definitely recommend, called The Room, like the Tommy Wiseau thing, but it's just a series of puzzle games. There's three of them out and they're all very cheap. And they're definitely worth the like couple of hours worth of playtime each. For their price. But yeah, so that's, I think, recommendation corner over. Remember to like us on all of our various things. Stars, likes, give us reviews, give us nice reviews, give us bad reviews.
Just shower us in those things that could be marshmallow shapes in any given baby cereal. Just shower us.
You can contact us on Twitter. You can find me at ThouArtFi. My Twitter is incredibly not safe for work, so keep that in mind.
But mine is safe for work. Like I don't even like not safe for work things anymore because I found out that like Twitter will randomly like effectively retweet liked things onto other people's timelines.
Yes.
So eventually I think I might create Weirdington Knights, 18 plus to harbor not safe for work stuff. But otherwise, yeah, you can check out at Weirdington E on Twitter. You can email me directly at WeirdingtonESQ .
You can also donate to Weird's Ko-Fi page. We are... I kept saying that we're going to try and get an episode out for this, and bonus episode for this month, but I think the way that this is actually going to work out is that we're going to start the Patreon on December and do our first bonus episode, which will be like, we'll be doing a $1 tier if you just want to give us money, a $5 tier for bonus episodes, and maybe more for other more complicated things. Maybe like set up like a Discord that people can chat to us directly about the whole FOA thing. Our first episode is likely going to be a review and breakdown of at least one of the Fallout pen and papers and kind of talk about how it's shit. I myself is a long seasoned tabletop dabbler. Weirdington is a self-described tabletop
dev.
I was going to say dev, play tester. What's it like?
Historian.
what's a non-mean word for like obsessive, like crank about them?
I think obsessive crank, like we can come up with other words, but obsessive crank does fit rather well.
Like I mean that in the nicest way possible, but you have a lot of opinions when it comes
to
tabletops.
Yeah, I do it in an endearing way. So I guess there's nothing left for us to do but contemplate the degree to which this was all been a terrible mistake.